On a beaten-down corner in New Orleans' Treme neighborhood, you can find a little lunch spot that's open from 11 till 3, 6 days a week. From the outside, it doesn't look like much, but Willie Mae's Scotch House is said to serve some of the best fried chicken you can find in America. After Hurricane Katrina, the restaurant recovered with a little help from a wide network of friends, and we're a little jealous in Studio 2A because NPR's Neda Ulubi visited this culinary landmark.
At around 10:45, the cars start bumping down St. Ann Street, a pretty name for a battered road warped from bearing waist-deep water for weeks after Hurricane Katrina. They're all headed for Willie Mae's Scotch House, where Willie Mae Seton's 28-year-old great-granddaughter is busily greasing the fryer.
We have fresh grease today, so you will have the prettiest chicken you ever seen in your life.
Willie Mae's Scotch House used to be a bar, but at some point, Willie Mae Seton started serving fried chicken, and the food just took over. In 2005, she won a James Beard Award, the Oscar of the food world. A friend of the family, Lolis Eric Eli, accompanied Seton to the banquet in New York.
This is somebody who literally had never heard of the James Beard Award before she won it.
Eli says perhaps an 88-year-old woman who'd spent a lifetime on her feet in the kitchen should not have been seated in the very back of the room. He escorted her on the slow walk to the podium.
By the time we actually got to the stage, there weren't but a few dry eyes in the house.
I want to thank each and every one of you all for made it possible for me to win this award. I'm so full, I can't say nothing.
4 months later came Hurricane Katrina. Seton packed her award and fled. But she could not stop worrying about the business she'd run on her own for over 50 years. Without telling her family, Seton made it back to New Orleans, where police found her huddled on the stoop of her ruined restaurant.
You know, at that point, she was 89 years old. She was somewhat disoriented and obviously very depressed.
Lolis Eric Eli and a group called the Southern Foodways Alliance rallied foodies from around the nation to help fix up Willie Mae's Scotch House.
Hey, my darling.
In a documentary made by the city's tourism department, Seton greets her volunteers.
All right, hook me. Come on here.
The
come
old
on.
Double-wide shotgun building, also Seton's home, was stripped down to its studs.
I don't have a bed to sleep in or nothing. But home is right here. I ain't going nowhere because I want my customers to see I'm back. I got to fix some fried chicken for them and whatever they want.
Seton became a cause celeb for star chefs around the country. Lolis Eric Eli says still, it took 3 years to get Willie Mae's Scotch House back in business.
On grand opening day, we had two James Beard Award-winning chefs in the kitchen. We had a James Beard nominee, John Currents, waiting tables. Based on that kind of firepower, this is the best restaurant in America that day.
According to some fans of fried chicken, it still is. Obviously, some fact-checking was in order. This is amazing chicken. I'm getting grease all over my microphone. Willie Mae Seton's chicken is not a family recipe. She got it from someone years ago, but she won't say who or how.
Willie Mae Seton takes more care with the recipe of her fried chicken than the national security folks take with the codes to launch the atom bomb. I mean, if she even thinks you're thinking about asking about the recipe, she says, I don't give my recipe to nobody.
Not even to her friend, Lolis Eric Eli. Supposedly, the seasoning's only salt and pepper.
We love this stuff. I mean, that's why we came here. So
that crispiness.
Jade Washman and Barbara Brove drove here for lunch from their jobs in downtown New Orleans.
It takes a little time to come here, a little more than an hour.
Did you guys know about this place before the hurricane?
No. And we've lived here forever.
The two learned about it on the Food Network. Willie Mae's great-granddaughter, Carrie Seton, says expectations have changed since the spot was known only to neighborhood regulars.
It definitely is pressure just to have first-time customers every single day and to know that you have chefs sitting in your restaurant, reporters, food critics, editors, every day. They're not going to let you know that they're sitting there, but I know.
Carrie Seton has taken over as cook, business manager, and spokesperson from her great-grandmother, who's now 92. Carrie wants to open a second Willie Mae Scotch House in the French Quarter and someday make her great-grandmother's business a national franchise. Neda Ulubi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today on Hidden Kitchens, the worlds of a young Canadian immigrant, an Italian family of pasta makers, and an Armenian grandmother converge in the story of the creation of the San Francisco treat. The Kitchen Sisters, producers Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, present The Birth of Rice-A-Roni.
Rice-A-Roni, the San Francisco treat. I'm Lois DiDomenico. I grew up in Edmonton, Canada. I met my husband, Tommy, in 1944 in San Francisco. His father and his brothers and he had a pasta factory. When the war was over, there was no place to live. All these hundreds of thousands of soldiers were coming home. So I saw this ad that said, lady who lived alone would like to rent out one room of her apartment. Mrs. Captanian. I had a liking for her right away. So we moved in. Tommy would work until, 7 o'clock every night at Golden Grain Pasta Company. I was alone a lot. I was only 18, and I was pregnant, and I had kitchen privileges. Well, I really wasn't much of a cook. And here was this Armenian lady, probably about 70 at the time, making yogurt on the back of the stove all day, every day. I didn't even know what the word yogurt meant.
My grandmother's name was Pailadzu Captanian. Grandma Cap is what we called her. My name is Ted Captanian. She babysat us when we were 4 or 5 years old. She would always be wanting to cook us stuffed grape leaves, baklava, and rice pilaf.
Pilaf, Armenian way. She taught me how to make that. We would bring her Golden Grain vermicelli. She wanted us to break it as small as rice if we could. The kitchen was teeny tiny, like a closet. But right around the corner was a huge big round table. And when she rolled out her dough for baklava, she would roll and roll until every bit of that dining room table was covered with this sheet of phyllo dough. She would hold it up and she would say, see, Lois, you have to be able to see through the dough. I can remember sitting there and Mrs. Captanian telling me her life story. She was in Armenia, 1915, 16, when the massacre happened, which, by the way, the Turkish people still don't agree that it ever happened. She was pregnant with one child and had two other boys.
This is a copy of her book, her memoirs of that exodus from Armenia. She wanted to guarantee that somebody knew what happened.
My name is Meline Pelivanyan, working in the Berlin State Library as the Armenia and Turkey specialist. About 15 years ago, I found by chance this little book from Pailadzu Captanian. It is a rare book. There are not so much first-hand memoirs of this time. It was 1915, the deportation of the Armenian population of Turkey began. Pailadzu Captanian left her two little sons with a Greek family. She knew that it would be death for all the Armenians. About 2 weeks later, the husband of Pailadzu is killed.
Where are my two children whom I abandoned? My heart is breaking with longing to see them again. Alone at night, I repeat cradle songs for their sake. And while I tell
Mrs. Captanian wrapped her feet in rags and walked through the Middle East.
There were only women, little children, and old men. They walked about 12 hours a day through mountains, and there were no food or little food.
Eventually, my grandmother made it to Syria, where she gave birth to my father after having walked for months to escape.
I used to sit in Mrs. Captanian's kitchen and listen to this amazing story of this woman. When I left her apartment, we got our own flat, and I made her Armenian pilaf a lot. One night, my husband and his brother Vincent were eating pilaf in my kitchen. Vincent looked at it and he took it apart and he said, you know, this would be great in a box.
We had a kitchen down in the plant. He would cook the dish up and we would taste it. I would bring home some samples and ask my wife how she liked it. Shake a baby, shake it, cause I love it when we needed a name for the product. We were saying, well, what is the product? Rice and macaroni. Why don't we call it Rice-a-roni? The name had a ring to it.
Rice-a-roni, the San Francisco treat.
Rice-a-roni, the delicious break from potatoes.
There were not very many packaged side dishes in the market in 1955. I'm Dennis DiDomenico, son of Lois and Tom DiDomenico. Everything was being geared towards less time in the kitchen, dishwashers and garbage disposals. The convenience factor was everything.
When I was young, we'd see these commercials for Rice-a-roni. Every time we hear that jingle, my father would say, you know, your grandmother gave a rice recipe to the people who started that company. So every time you hear it, you can think of your grandmother. To be honest, we kind of thought, could that possibly be true, that this iconic American dish, could that actually be attributed to some recipe my Armenian grandmother gave to someone years ago?
I still make pilaf the way Mrs. Kaptanian taught me. The impact she had on me and my life, I only lived there 4 months, but it was 4 months that brought all these things together. Myself from Canada, Tommy, Italian, Mrs. Kaptanian, Armenian, all that converging in San Francisco in 1946. And out of that comes Rice-a-roni.
Hidden Kitchens is produced by the Kitchen Sisters and mixed by Jim McKee. If you're a fan of Rice-a-roni, or even if you're not, we have a version of the rice pilaf recipe that started it all at npr.org.
Support for Hidden Kitchens comes from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, with additional support from the National Endowment for the Arts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Deborah Amos.
For NPR's Kitchen Window, this is Bonnie Wolf. Kevin Weeks is a personal chef in Knoxville, Tennessee. He also teaches cooking classes and blogs at Seriously Good. He has written about sandwiches for Kitchen Window Online and joins me today. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Bonnie. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Oh, excellent.
So you've written a story about sandwiches. And
oh, yeah. They are so underappreciated.
Do you think so? I think that they've become sort of trendy.
I think people tend to take them for granted and don't realize what a wonderful meal they are.
Well, you have a rather broad definition of sandwich.
Well, that's true.
How would you define a sandwich?
A sandwich needs to be something you can eat with your hands. And the other is it needs to be enclosed in some sort of bread. And that bread can be sliced bread, or it can be a pastry, such as in the case of a Cornish pasty or a calzone or an empanada.
Well, let's talk first about the traditional sandwich,
okay,
which is, in your piece for Kitchen Window, you say that the bread is very important and that people often, you come to the bread as kind of an afterthought.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely essential. I discovered the importance of bread when I started making my own pizza dough, and it just totally changed the character of the pizza. And about the same time, I started also making bread and found that it really changed the character of my sandwiches.
Now, do I have to make my own bread to have a decent sandwich?
Well, you don't have to. I enjoy baking bread, and so I don't mind doing it. But these days, you can find good bread at the specialty bakers. And most towns now have a dedicated bakery somewhere.
Now, do you have any guidance on when to use white bread, when to use whole wheat bread, rye bread?
Not particularly. I do like the traditions. I like rye bread with ham, but I like a rye grilled cheese sandwich.
Oh, that sounds good. How do you make a really good grilled cheese sandwich?
Well, first off, my favorite bread for grilled cheese is James Beard's sourdough white, because it has a very open sort of crumb, and yet it's dense enough to do well on a grill. Then you butter both sides of it, put one side down, butter side down, in a cold cast iron skillet.
Mm-hmm.
Put several slices, and I like the Grafton cheddar cheese.
That's Vermont.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Several slices of that, about 3/8 of an inch thick.
Ooh.
And then top it with the other slice of bread and turn the heat to medium low.
Okay.
And cook it until the bottom is brown, and that'll take you about 5 to 6 to 7 minutes, depending. And during that time, and this is the great thing about that particular bread, is because of the open crumb, the cheese soaks down into the bread.
Mm.
And then you flip it over, and the cheese soaks down into the bread while you brown off the other side, and you get this, oh, it's an amazingly good grilled cheese sandwich with cheese just distributed throughout it, hot melted cheese. Mm.
It sounds fabulous. I'm drooling. Well, let's go to some of the other things that you include in your sandwich definitions. You mentioned Cornish pasties. Tell us a little bit about that.
One of my absolute favorites. Traditionally, they were made in Cornwall in England for the miners. A pasty is a turnover type thing. It's made with a pastry crust, and it's filled with meat and potatoes and whatever else you might have around. And then they're baked, and the idea was they carry this, wrapped in a handkerchief, they carry this pasty down into the mines with them. And then during their lunch break, they open it up, they can eat the pasty, holding on to one corner of it to avoid getting coal dust on the rest of it. And they get to the very end, and they've got this one dirty corner of pasty left, and they discard that.
And yeah. I've made them. They're not that hard.
No, they're not. They're wonderful both hot and cold, and so they make a great picnic food.
And an empanada is quite similar to a pasty.
Mm-hmm. A Spanish take on it, a Latin take on it.
What would be in a Spanish empanada? What would the filling be?
My favorite recipe uses pork, but fish is also not unusual on feast days.
Really? Calzone is yet another sort of version of...
Well, a calzone is essentially a pizza folded in half and sealed. So, again, it looks like a turnover. It's usually made with pizza dough, which is a risen dough. And you fill it with the sorts of things you would ordinarily put in a pizza, put on a pizza, and seal it over and then bake it. And, again, it's a great one-handed sort of meal.
What are some of your other favorite sandwiches encased in pastry or in bread?
Probably my absolute favorite sandwich is a good Reuben.
And how do you make a Reuben?
You've got to have a good rye bread. This is one where I frequently make my own bread. I like very thinly sliced corned beef, piled high. The common condiment on a Reuben is Thousand Island dressing, and I make my own sort of version of that. It's slightly sweet, which stands it very nicely against the tartness of the sauerkraut, which also goes on a Reuben.
What gives the dressing the sweetness? Pickles?
Pickles, right, and a little bit of ketchup.
Huh, okay.
And then you brush it with, spread it with butter, and again, grill it like you would a grilled cheese. Oh, and I also usually add a good Swiss to it, something like a Jarlsberg.
And you cook it the same way you would your grilled cheese sandwich?
Exactly.
Wow. How often do you eat a sandwich?
Oh, I eat at least a couple of sandwiches a week, and they're often for supper.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they're substantial sandwiches. And you think about it, you've got some sort of vegetable in there usually. It could be lettuce, tomatoes, sauerkraut, pickles. You've got bread, which is a carbohydrate. There's usually some sort of protein in the form of meat and cheese. You've got dairy and the cheese. I mean, it's a really a complete meal in one very neat package.
Well, Kevin, this has been very illuminating and very enticing, and I thank you so much.
Sure. Go make a sandwich.
The Maryland summer is in full swelter now, with the air as hot as a blast from an open oven and hanging heavier than a wet beach towel.
Cookbook author and commentator Nancy Baggett has been pondering how to beat the heat.
My solution is to heed the call of my personal sirens, the syrups, and stop in at a snowball stand. I always get giddy seeing the kaleidoscope of neon-colored bottles. Perhaps it's just the heat waves shimmering off the parking lot and that pulsing thrumming of overheated cicadas. Maybe I'll try one of the fanciful new-age flavors like Titanic or Chiller or the refreshing-looking sea green Tidal Wave. Or how about the dessert and the slurp offerings like egg custard, tiramisu, or wedding cake? These sound too filling, so I consider the cocktail takeoffs like Mai Tai, margarita, and pina colada. But when my turn comes, I forget to act grown up. Cherry on one side, chocolate on the other, and heavy on the marshmallow topping, I blurt out. The sensation is stunning. Sweet, tart fruit, chocolate, and gooey marshmallow mingled with finely shaved ice. Alternately sipping, slurping, and munching, I take refuge under a sliver of awning and ravish my prize. Slow down, I tell myself. No, not to savor, but to avoid the guzzler scourge, the ice cream headache. As I gulp the last bits of slush, I ponder my weakness for this simple, some would say unsophisticated, others god-awful concoction. Perhaps it's due to my snowball-deprived childhood. I grew up on a farm, so my rare snowball encounters came during summer visits with cousins who lived in a backwater one-snowball-stand town. Compared to today's venues, Bud's Snow Hut was Spartan. One fellow in a rickety wooden stall with a hand-lettered sign and basic choices like grape, cola, and good old cherry. No toppers or two syrup options in those days, but his wares were wonderfully teeth-achingly sweet and chilling, and at 10 cents apiece fit our budgets. And they turned our tongues garish colors that lasted for hours. The snowball stands I frequent nowadays tend to be much fancier, though no more enticing, and sport clever names like Chilly Willies, Sweet Shivers, and Icy Delights. Their rainbow of flavors is so mesmerizing, I usually have trouble making up my mind. No, I don't. It's always cherry on one side, chocolate on the other, and heavy on the marshmallow topping.
There's a recipe for that marshmallow topping in commentator Nancy Bagot's latest cookbook. It's called The All-American Dessert Book.